Welcome to Harder to Kill Radio, a top-rated health and fitness podcast. On this week's episode, I'm joined by healthy hormone doctor and advocate, Dr. Laura Bryden. We're talking all about the obstacles to hormonal vitality in this modern world, why hormonal resiliency is critical, and what's normal and not regarding hormonal health for women. Okay, let's do this. What is shaken? Welcome to episode number 40. I'm your host, Steph Godreau. I am so excited that you're taking a little bit of time out of your day to tune in to Harder to Kill Radio and hear from my incredible guest, Dr. Laura Bryden. You know, my goal on this show is to find the most fascinating people in the world. These are folks who are dedicating their lives to building unbreakable humans through fitness, nutrition, and mindset. And then, of course, to share their expertise with you so you can apply it to your life. Be sure to visit stupideasypaleo.com/40 to get the show notes from this episode and links to everything Dr. Bryden and I talked about. Okay, time to jump into the show. Welcome back to Harder to Kill Radio. I am extremely excited to have this very, very intelligent, very wonderful, kind woman with me today. This is Dr. Laura Bryden. She is a naturopath. She lives now in New Zealand.
Yes.
Okay, now in New Zealand, was in Australia. And we had the very, very great pleasure of meeting last year at the Ancestral Health Society Symposium in Queenstown, New Zealand. So welcome to Harder to Kill Radio.
Thanks, Steph. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, you know, I sat in on every presentation at AHS, and I came back. I think you were either after a break or after lunch, and I remember coming in on your presentation, and I think I missed the first bullet point that you were talking about in your presentation, and I was like, oh my gosh, this stuff is so good. I couldn't believe I had missed it, so I'm very glad that the presentations are all on video, but I definitely want to ask you a little bit about your presentation in a bit. And so we're going to talk about hormones today and all of the stuff that you do, which I'm really excited about because I think there's like more people are kind of aware of hormones these days. What do you?
Absolutely. So a lot of people are calling 2015 the year of the period. Ooh. And I started using that phrase, you know, way back in April, May last year. I released my book, Period Repair Manual, last year, and it was the perfect year to do it because there's a growing consciousness, this awareness about the importance of women's hormones. I think we're at a watershed moment for women's hormones. And I'm really excited to be part of the period revolution.
It's such great stuff. And, you know, when you were speaking at AHS, we had a chance to chat kind of on the way to dinner one night. And I was really just struck by the authenticity and passion that you have for this topic. And it's not just like, this is the hot thing at the moment. But it's obvious to anybody who listens to you and reads your material and sees your book. And if you're watching this on YouTube, I'm holding up Dr. Bryden's book right here, which I've had the pleasure to look at, and it's fantastic. But you know, I was really struck by the authenticity and true. Like you are a teacher of this stuff to other women. And as you were saying before we got on the show here today, you know, making this stuff accessible for people. So kind of, you know, fill us in a little bit on your backstory. Were you always interested and geeked out on hormonal stuff? I know you had, before you were a naturopath, you had a slightly different career track. So fill us in on all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So my first incarnation, my first work was as a wildlife biologist, evolutionary biologist. I actually studied bats, which is not something that I share a lot because sometimes I think people might be a little bit creeped out by that. But I studied the gender differences in foraging patterns between male and female bats. So I was actually way back then, 20 years ago, looking at, you know, reproductive health and how the specialness of females. Mm-hmm. And then I moved on and trained as a naturopathic doctor, mm-hmm. Qualified in 1997. And I did not set out to treat hormones from the beginning. No. Mm-hmm. What happened was, and I think perhaps where some of my passion for this comes from, is I just learned from the patients who were coming to see me. I mean, this is back in the mid 90s. Things aren't that much better now, to be honest, but the things I was seeing that women were dealing with, and, you know, the high dose birth control pills, the surgeries, the really just complete lack of help that they were getting anywhere else. And I very early on the ground working just realized I have the tools. My profession, you know, the diet and nutritional supplements and herbal medicine are highly effective treatment for women. Mm. And they need it. It was this just huge gap in the world of, you know, what women needed. So I think from the beginning, I was just learning as much as I could to make a real difference in women's lives.
Yeah, and you certainly have. I know, you know, as we were saying, 2015 kind of seems to be kind of this breakthrough moment for hormones and I won't say our understanding because I think we have a long way to go there. But, you know, it almost seems like now there's, to me, perhaps like a wanting to blame everything on hormones. Like, so it seems like we've almost swung the pendulum. You know, we had no idea that certain things were controlled by hormones. And now sometimes it seems like every answer is like hormones. Every answer is pointing there. Do you think that's the case? I mean, are you seeing that with your patients?
Yeah, it's interesting, the phrase blaming hormones. And I think actually we chatted about this in our little chat before dinner.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I'm a cheerleader for women's hormones. I think, well, I know, you know, they are powerful. I mean, they're so powerful. And actually, estradiol, which is one of our most powerful hormones, men need it too. You know, it's important for bone health in both genders, insulin sensitivity, libido in both genders, which mm-hmm. is interesting. And we've come out of this place where, yeah, it's common knowledge. It's kind of, yes, we know testosterone is very, you know, fantastic hormone and men need it for mood. No one would kind of debate that, you know, men need testosterone for who they are. Mm. And yet, that is now just coming into awareness, seemingly kind of for the first time, that women need these hormones and that estrogen and progesterone affect us at every level, including mood, you know, brain health, bone health, metabolism, insulin sensitivity, all of these things. These are some of the things I touched on in my talk. So mm-hmm. in answer to your question, is it valid to kind of bring female hormones into any conversation really about health? Yes, mm-hmm. it's valid. I wouldn't call it blaming them, but yes, sure. we're involving them.
Yeah, and yeah. I think the choice of phraseology almost comes from this idea that, and a lot of times when we talk about hormones, we almost assign them this sort of like, okay, they're screwing everything up, these things are bad, certain hormones, like for example, cortisol is oftentimes sure. seen as a negative sort of thing. You know, can you kind of give the lay people out there listening a quick little primer, like, are hormones bad or is it the balance, and how do we kind of listen to our bodies when it comes to that stuff?
Yeah, that's a great question. Okay. Hormones are not bad, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, we would die without cortisol. We'd die without insulin. I mean, we know this, we don't do very well at all without, you know, any of the hormones. So it's about, and I don't even like, I don't know, I'm moving beyond the word balance because I feel like that's a bit too nebulous. You know, we need to work with our hormones and collaborate with them and one of the things I talk about in my book is a term called hormonal resilience. Mm. So we need to have create the right kind of playing field, if you will, or the right situation for the hormones to do what they need to do. And one of the things I'll just bring in the concept of inflammation, mm. chronic inflammation, and how that interferes with hormonal activity in the body. And inflammation is probably something I'm guessing your listeners have heard about. It's a topic that comes up a lot in nutritional medicine and health. And that's very relevant for hormonal health as well. So when we can reduce inflammation, it clears the way for progesterone to work, for, you know, to get a better response from cortisol so it doesn't have to go too high, for, you know, insulin to work better.
Sure. That's a really good way to put it. And I like your analogy of kind of the playing field, and really the issues with the word balance, because I think sometimes we expect that things will be sort of equal or even equal and opposite. I like to use the term harmony, and I like to kind of think of an orchestra, because you can have all the players there, right? You've got all the instruments, but if you know, the strings are playing in harmony with the woodwinds and you know, you get sort of a noise, right? And it's not that they're not there, but if these things aren't all playing together, certainly there can be some disruption in the beautiful melody that's supposed to come out of that stuff.
That's a great analogy. And the other thing I'll say about women's hormones in particular, which is different from men, and perhaps that's why women's hormones have always been put into the too hard basket, is they fluctuate. Mm. That's what they do. You know, one thing I like to say is, if our hormones were balanced, we wouldn't have periods, because the only way you can get to a period is to go through these pretty dramatic, pretty interesting ups and downs of estrogen and progesterone. And that's what it's all about for us. And so we want our hormones to fluctuate and go up and down. We just need to adapt to that or be resilient to that.
Yeah, it's such a great point. You know, For people listening out there, and you know, any guys out there, or even some ladies out there, we're going to talk about some period stuff. And you know, I like to just think, this is just life. This is normal. This is a part of things, right? Like, so many times, do you get the sense from, you know, what you see out there online, or maybe with your patients, like, people still don't want to talk about this? I mean,
it's changing. This is the year of the period. It's coming into the broader conversation.
Yeah.
Men, I'll share one thing. I've been quite surprised and pleased at the response to my book from men. And I don't know why I thought, I think I was even still operating in that old idea. Well, men don't want to hear about this. This isn't part of their, but of course they do, because they might be practitioners. They might be trying to help women. They might be married to a woman. They have daughters. They have sisters. They care. You know, it's because we're all humans. And so it's a pretty major human experience to have periods.
Absolutely. And it's really a part of what it is a part of what it means to be female. And I think so many times we kind of are like this annoying thing, or we don't know a lot about it, or we've been on birth control for a long period of time and don't really understand how we're supposed to naturally function. So maybe that's what leads to some of it being a little bit unknown or scary. I don't know. What do you think?
Okay, I want to say something, make sure I get a chance to say this.
Yeah,
this
go.
This is one of my key messages. Pill bleeds are not periods. This is a big part of the emperor's new clothes, just bizarre thing that we need to change about our current thinking about women's health. Because to sort of work into the idea, and I know you don't think that, but a lot of people, a lot of doctors think that, a lot of, you know, women think we can control our periods on a very tight schedule just by taking these pills. But there's no basis to it, because that is nothing really whatsoever to do with women's own cycling. So
So I want to get into this and talk about it a little bit more. So first of all, like, can you give us kind of the general overview rundown of, in your opinion, in your professional practice, like, what it means to have a natural cycle?
Okay. It's all about ovulation.
Okay.
So we need ovulation, obviously, is the event where the ovaries release an egg. It's been compartmentalized into just as a reproductive event only, but it's not. Mm. So even for those of us who don't have kids or don't want kids, or, you know, it's really, it's involved in fertility, of course. But it's not just that. Ovulation is how it's during the process of moving towards ovulation, and then after ovulation, that's really the only way that we make the two main hormones that we need, estradiol, which is the main estrogen, and progesterone. Mm. There is actually no other way to make them. So when we shut down ovulation, we essentially castrate women. Mm. And I'm sorry, I don't always use that term in podcasts.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think so that's okay. So you're asking sort of what the key events of a period. Yeah, it's that. It's the pre-ovulation phase where we're primarily estrogen base, you know, estrogen creatures, and then post-ovulation where our progesterone comes in and we need a lot of progesterone, which is a wonderful hormone. Mm-hmm. And if we make enough progesterone, that helps us to have an easier period, perhaps, you know, lighter, less painful. Yeah. Less PMS.
Less PMS. I think we can all agree that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I like that you sort of put it in that context, because so many times I hear from women or I hear from athletes in the gym or whatever it is that have gone amenorrheic for whatever reason, and they're not having a period. And sometimes, especially it seems more common with the younger ladies out there, they tend to think, well, I'm not trying to get pregnant. I'm not trying to have a child at this moment. So in terms of fertility, it doesn't matter, right? Yeah. I'm not trying to have a baby. Yeah. So ovulation isn't that important. And I really like how you bring that up as kind of like, that's like a global thing. And we need that event to, you know, start that hormonal cascade in either direction. I think that's super, super important to mention. Yeah. Okay. So let's kind of dig into that a little bit. I know at AHS you talked about five main obstacles to hormonal vitality, and I think I was sitting on the floor during your presentation, and I was just taking screenshots of everything because I was like, "This is so good." And obviously, we'll link to that presentation. But can you kind of expound a little bit upon this idea of hormonal vitality and maybe give us a few of those obstacles, those roadblocks that you talked about? Like, why, you know, for ladies out there who aren't trying to have a baby right now, like, why does hormonal vitality still matter?
Yeah. By vitality, I guess I meant obviously the presence of our reproductive hormones. In the talk, I was primarily speaking about steroid reproductive hormones, which mm-hmm. we'll focus our conversation on today. Of course, there's also thyroid hormones and adrenal hormones, sure. And these are all, and insulin, and this is all very important. But my main message has been our reproductive hormones, both for men and women, are very important for our vitality in terms of its impact on mood and bone health and insulin sensitivity, metabolism. And you're talking about women in the gym, you know, needing, you know, the right amount of steroid hormones, reproductive hormones, to be able to gain muscle mass and mm-hmm. Reach your goals. So, you know, and there are a number of things can interfere with that. I think one of the things I said in the talk is, you know, how far have we departed from the health of how far has our own hormonal vitality departed from that of our ancestors? Mm. You know, I think for all of us, there's issues. But one thing is, men have managed to hang on to largely hang on to that steroid hormone, mm-hmm. whereas women have not. So their vitality, in terms of if we're defining hormonal vitality as the presence of those reproductive steroids, many women, it's an almost unrecognizable state mm-hmm. compared to our ancestral state.
Yeah. Okay. So can you sort of, and I know you made a pretty strong case against the use of hormonal birth control
yes.
in that presentation. And I'm wondering if you can kind of give us some bullet points to chew on for people who are listening who've maybe never considered that there would be drawbacks, or it's just what you do, like it's a rite of passage, or they're perhaps using that particular hormonal birth control to manage other symptoms, which seems like a pretty common practice, you know, like I have acne or whatever the case might be. Can you sort of give us a few of your best bullet points as to some of those issues that people may not know about?
Yeah, issues in terms of reasons not to use it.
Yeah.
Well, primarily what I was saying before, that it just castrates, you know, us hormonally completely. I think we'd lose entirely that hormonal vitality that is our legacy that women deserve to have. So that's the primary thing. I mean, I guess then you can do kind of a shopping list of side effects, which is dramatic drop in libido, which is kind of laughed about. And, you know, but I think it's quite important. I think women have the right to a libido. Mm-hmm. It's a permanent effect on bone density, a loss of muscle mass. That's something else, that the inability to gain muscle mass during exercise, mm-hmm. Depression, anxiety, fundamental change in the microbiome. Probably a lot of your listeners are interested in the health of the intestinal bacteria. That's also affected by intestinal by hormonal birth control. So I think I make the argument in the book that in terms of what you said about using the pill to control symptoms, it does. It is effective for things like acne, certainly, but it doesn't in any sense correct the underlying problems, and it really only masks it. Mm. And it prevents women from accessing what I call our monthly report card, which is to check in, which is to be able to use our PMS symptoms and our skin and our everything to see, you know, what underlying health issues are the ultimate cause of that. So what underlying inflammation or sugar in the diet or lack of exercise or whatever it is interfering with our hormonal resilience or our hormonal vitality. And if you take the birth control pill, I think you lose a chance to see that. You lose a chance to therefore act on it.
Yeah, that's such a good way to frame that discussion. And I know for me personally, and not to get too much into my own personal story, but I did get off of hormonal birth control about a year and a half ago, and started, you know, tracking my basal body temperature, not beta, yeah. basal metabolic rate, basal body temperature. And
well, it is your metabolic rate as well.
Exactly. And yeah. I was surprised to even start making correlations between things like when post-ovulation, when my body temperature is higher, I tend to not sleep quite as well. You know, this is like over a year and a half of tracking that sort of thing, but it's amazing how I've become much more in tune to my own body and the changes that I notice, even when I'm in the gym, for example. I know that kind of leading up to menstruation, that especially a couple days right before, I'm not feeling very strong in general. Like, so I know that at those times, it's okay for me to, I understand why I feel that way, first of all. And then, like, I know it's not the best time for me to try to really push myself. I might back off. I might do something different where I'm not pushing myself quite as hard or I'm not lifting quite as heavy. And I think that's a really good, it's a really important thing for especially women, I think, in my position who are really athletically minded or are pushing themselves hard pretty physically. But it's hard to know that stuff unless you've been keeping tabs on it.
Yeah. You're checking it. This is the period app. This is also the year of the period apps, and everybody, you know, everybody uses them now. I mean, I don't know if you use an app to track yours. You can do it on pen and paper as well, but it just makes sense. It's because we do, our body's different. And the reason you'll get that, probably that bit of fatigue or a difference in your muscles as during those couple days before your period, is that's when you're both your estrogen and progesterone are just dive bombing. Like they're just kind of coming down, you know, by many degrees, you know, sort of many amounts each day.
Yeah.
So you could feel that. You could feel that in your energy. Of course.
And it's kind of comforting to know why. You know, it's nice to go to go be able to go, oh yeah, okay, that's why that's happening. It's not just all in my head. As women, you know, we do experience those fluctuations for normal reasons. And so that's kind of my own personal plug for that stuff. But you know, if you were going to be talking to say someone who is thinking about maybe exiting from a more of a hormonal birth control type method, like what are some of the things that you would counsel them to pay attention to or, you know, kind of think about if they were deciding to get off of that stuff, regardless, like maybe pregnancy aside? And that sort of thing. But, you know, what are some of the things that you find people are concerned about? We're going to take just a minute to pause, and I'd love to thank our show sponsors. These are two incredible companies run by two very smart women, and they are Fat Face Skincare and PrepDish.com. And we're going to take a listen really quickly to the very special offer. This one is super good, that Allison Schaff, she's the creator of PrepDish, has just especially for Harder to Kill radio listeners. Let's listen into that. We are here today with Allison Schaff. She is the creator of PrepDish.com, and we're going to get a little bit of insight into what Allison does and why you should definitely check out PrepDish to make your food and meal prep so much easier. Welcome, Allison.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. You know, how do you take your private chef experience into what Prep Dish is and what you offer your clients now through PrepDish.com?
Yeah, it worked really well because, you know, I basically spent several years creating recipes and figuring out what works, figuring out what recipes can be made ahead of time and what recipes people enjoy eating. So it really gave me a chance to really try everything out.
A lot of special insight there since you've been there and you're able to really kind of get in there and know what works. Okay, we're going to head back to the episode with Dr. Bryden to hear more about healthy hormones and how to keep ourselves on track.
Exiting from a more of a hormonal birth control type method, like what are some of the things that you would counsel them to pay attention to or, kind of think about if they were deciding to get off of that stuff, regardless, like maybe pregnancy aside, and that sort of thing. But, you know, what are some of the things that you find people are concerned about when they're getting off of hormonal birth control?
That's a great question. Because you see so many blog posts out there that are, you know, so many articles that kind of say, you know, these are the things to do when you're coming off birth control, this kind of shopping list of do this and this and this. But what my experience clinically is, it's not quite that simple because it's so different for every woman. So the very first thing to consider, the very first thing to ask is, what were your periods like before you took hormonal birth control? Mm. Because remember I said earlier that pill bleeds are not periods. So let's say someone's been on the pill or hormonal birth control, and I don't just mean the pill, it could be the NuvaRing or injections or Implanon or these are all, it's, you know, they all work primarily in the same way by shutting down ovulation.
Sure.
So then, if you've been on hormonal birth control for 15 years, you actually don't know. It's possible the last time you had a real period, you were, say, 19 years old or something. So this is what I always ask my patients. I'm trying to make a plan for them where it's going to go as smoothly as possible. So I want to know what we're looking out for. Were the periods very heavy? Was there a problem with skin? Mm-hmm. Did they come at all? Were they regular? Because if they were irregular at 17, 18, 19, now at 35, they're probably going to be irregular, although there could be some things could have changed with the health because again, periods are our report card of our health. So if someone has in the meantime, here's an example, like say someone had lack of periods when they were a teenager, possibly because they had something called PCOS, which is a very common condition called polycystic ovarian syndrome. Let's say, they had that when they were a teenager, possibly because their diet was terrible and they were eating a lot of sugar and they weren't exercising and all these things. And then, there's two ways that could go. I mean, that could have gotten worse if the lifestyle hasn't changed. And also because the pill, and I do want to get this message across to you. I do have a few bullet points I'm getting out across here.
Yeah, yeah.
The pill causes insulin resistance. So it essentially causes PCOS. Mm. So to take the pill to treat PCOS is almost one of the most nonsensical things you can do because it causes insulin resistance, which causes PCOS. It shuts down ovulation, and PCOS is primarily a condition of not ovulating. So there's two ways. So you went on the pill at 18, not having periods. And then, if nothing changed in your lifestyle, like it could actually be a lot worse now that you're coming off the pill. You could find you just basically can't get periods without some changes. Mm. But the other way it could go is if, let's say, during all these years on the pill, someone had been getting healthier and doing exercise and eating better and stopping sugar, and then they might find that it's quite a different story when they come off the pill this time.
Sure.
So, yeah. So I asked, what were your periods like before? And also, did you have a break from the pill before and what happened? Mm. And then I try to sort of perhaps treat some of those issues in a lead up time to coming off the pill to make it, to smooth the way for that change. Yeah.
Such great advice. And so I'm glad you brought up PCOS because it is a topic that people ask me about all the time. I'm the first to say, like, I'm not a PCOS expert. There are people who are and who talk a lot about it, yourself included. Yeah. And I think it's a question that a lot of women have. They're like, I was either told I have PCOS or I suspect I might have PCOS. You know, what are some of the, and I know on your blog, you talk about kind of three different types. One being insulin resistant and non-insulin resistant, kind of the two main pathways there. And then from there, there's a little bit of delineation. But can you kind of give us a quick little overview as to what PCOS is and for many women, what the underlying causes are? And then perhaps what are some
general, I know it's going to depend on the person, some general things that people might want to think about if they're going to try to get that back on track.
I'm really glad this came up in your podcast. It's a huge issue. They think it affects, it seems to be, up to 1 in 10, possibly even more, between 1 in 5 and 1 in 10 women.
Wow.
It's common. It's common. And there's a number of reasons for that. First thing I want to say, this is very important. Mm-hmm. PCOS is not one thing. Mm-hmm. It's what we call an umbrella diagnosis. So it's a term, and this is what happens in medicine. This is the state we're in. We've defined these diseases, I guess, we've given names to things and we slap these labels on people. Yep. And with PCOS isn't the only example of this. Many times, depression might be another one, for example, or mm-hmm. other things. It's a set of symptoms that have arisen in different people for lots of different reasons. So PCOS is a set of symptoms. The symptoms are irregular ovulation, which means irregular periods, because remember, ovulation is the key event. You can't basically have a real period without ovulating, although you can have, I'll say here, you can have what's called an anovulatory bleed, mm-hmm. which is actually not a real period, but it's kind of so that can confuse things. So so the main symptoms of PCOS are irregular periods or no periods, and symptoms of too much testosterone or what we call androgens. There's lots of different kinds of male type hormones that women get. And that can cause skin, acne, facial hair, which can be quite bad mm-hmm. for some women, body hair, hair loss on the head. So it's quite a distressing symptom, especially for young women. It really affects self-esteem. And about 70-80%, so we have this group population of women who've been given the label of PCOS, possibly based on a combination of symptoms. They might have been given it based on an ultrasound finding, which I want to say is not valid. You cannot diagnose PCOS with an ultrasound, mm-hmm. just flat out. That's a myth. That's a mistake that's made. So within that population of people who've been given the diagnosis, about 70-80% of those women, the primary cause of the condition is an underlying problem with insulin resistance. Mm. And the other 20-30%, it's something else, which I kind of, classify on my blog post.
Yeah. So if you're dealing with insulin resistance, for people who may not know, and I kind of know the answer to this, but I'm going to, for the sake of people listening, ask you to, talk about some of the general lifestyle factors, because I think a lot of times people tend to think insulin resistance is only about the food that I eat. And so what are some general things that people might want to think about when they are trying to steer that insulin resistance back toward more of an insulin sensitive state?
Exactly. Well, one thing is muscle mass and muscle. This fits in well with your work. I mean, exercise, not just muscle mass, but muscle sensitivity. So that's one of the ways that exercise benefits. One of the many ways that exercise benefits us is it improves what's called insulin sensitivity. And that can happen very quickly, just within a few weeks, even before you've had any sort of noticeable. And it's not because of the weight loss. We always sort of tie it in with weight. It's exercise is beneficial because of all these other hormonal things that it's doing. So that's a big one. Mm-hmm. Diet, of course, is important. And I know you probably talked about this with other guests. I'll just put my 2 cents in. I think one of the biggest drivers of insulin resistance is fructose and high fructose, desserts and sweets and soft, sweet drinks. So that's something that seems to be a lot of people overlook. Mm-hmm. I get patients who are valiantly avoiding potatoes, but having, date balls and fruit juice and all these, and it's like they've kind of missed the main thing that they need to do.
Sure.
The other factors are lots of different medications. So hormonal birth control worsens insulin resistance, antibiotics do, certain, I think, antihistamines. And so there's other sort of things that we're doing. And of course, stress.
Yeah.
Can definitely affect insulin sensitivity. And, sorry, one to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
Environmental toxins.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned the antibiotic thing too, because we know antibiotics have the ability to disrupt kind of your normal gut flora. And you were mentioning earlier how that stuff can kind of cycle back. So I can see why these topics can be they're so multifactorial. They're so, I won't say complicated, but I'll say complex,
and really starting to kind of tease out what you should approach first and what you should perhaps work on first, I think might be one of the reasons why people get a bit overwhelmed with this. And so they tend to look for the really either simple solution, or sometimes they tend to look for some kind of pharmaceutical intervention, perhaps, because it's the way to kind of simplify and like attack one of those components, right?
Wouldn't it be nice if metformin was the drug they give, if it could solve all the problems? But I mean, that's a dream. I guess I would love that if it was that simple, but it's not, as we both know.
Yeah.
There's another post on my blog which your listeners might want to see, which I called 4 Steps to Reverse Insulin Resistance. I was trying to address exactly what you're saying. It can all feel a bit overwhelming, especially when you see an expert sitting here listing like 12 things that you know, affect it. You really just need to know, as you're right, just where to start. So those 4 things I'll say to you quickly that I decided to put in that blog post are quit sugar, do exercise, take magnesium, which is actually, I didn't get to in my talk. I had to kind of skip over that part. But magnesium is a powerful insulin sensitizer and quite safe and easy supplement for people. Sure. And I think I did, I forget what my 4th one, I think I did sleep. So sleep affects it as well.
Sure.
Those
are all really good places for people to kind of dig in. Yeah. And I'll definitely link that specific article in the show notes so people can click right there and dig into that a bit more. So the last thing I want to ask you is one of the most recent blog posts you have written is about a tweet that you made. And this the sort of replies that you got about this tweet, which was the tweet was about women losing their periods on low-carb diets. Yes. And you got a lot of pushback on that, I guess, from what your blog post about that said. But I'm interested in, can you sort of give us a quick commentary on why low-carb diets could be problematic for women and what the kind of underlying, you know, pathway is there? Like, what do we need to be aware of?
Okay. So, first thing, it's interesting that this is coming right after our conversation about insulin resistance. It's perfect timing for this question. So we are all individuals. So some, right from the start, before I even answer that question, I will say some women do extremely well on a low-carb diet. And those would be women, for example, that are strongly insulin resistant and have been not having periods because they have PCOS. In that case, that group of women arguably have lost their periods because to a high-carb diet. So, you know, but on the other end of things, if we therefore say, okay, that worked for them and avoiding carbs is better for periods in this group, therefore, you know, avoiding all carbs must be good for all women, just doesn't play out. And the reality is, the clinical reality is, there are these young health conscious women, they're trying to do the best they can. They're taking it to the nth degree to do what they can. And that could be over-exercise too, but that could be what I'm seeing is not even that strict, but, you know, fairly a reasonably strict avoidance of all starches shuts down their periods in this particular, you know, some vulnerable women. And I suspect it's, I don't know the mechanism. I don't think any of us know, because no one's asked that question in the science or the research to my knowledge, but I suspect it's really just a matter of the hypothalamus, or, you know, our hormonal command center is just not receiving the signals, the insulin and the leptin, that's another hormone that we need, signals that there's an adequate food supply. Women's hormones are very sensitive to food supply. This is something else I talked about in my talk. And that makes sense because, historically, we would have needed to sort of only reproduce when conditions were right. So, that's the short answer. But I was surprised. I had to write that post because I had these guys, I don't know who they were, some guys, you know, tweeting that said, well, that's wrong. You're just wrong because there's no science behind that. It's like, well, you know, it's just happening. It's just a fact.
Sure. Yeah. And just because we're not seeing it in the literature and there aren't studies done on it doesn't mean it's an observed phenomenon. And it's certainly something that I see with athletes in the gym, with other females who I know who are kind of hard chargers and sometimes not even. I mean, like, I'm really glad in that post you really took sort of pains to mention that we're all sort of different and what works for one person may not work for another. And so I think that's really, really important. You know, we tend to use these heuristics to explain things like low-carb diets are great because they're going to help, you know, sensitize you to insulin and this and that. And and then on the other hand, we have, you know, the opposite of that. So it's easy to kind of get caught up in that stuff. And I really like that point that you made, which was for some people, it works wonderfully. Yeah. And for other people, it's devastating. So, you know, there... Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. No, keep going.
I was just going to say for, you know, for women, it really all comes down to understanding the inputs and the outputs, and they're checking in with themselves and all that stuff is so, so important. And it's not quite enough to say, oh, well, like this is just a thing that happens, or, you know, like this is what everybody else is doing, so I should do it too.
And overlaid on that, just to tie back to what we were talking about before, you know, valuing periods, valuing women's hormones, I do get the feeling at some level that, you know, I don't know, that it's like, yeah, it stops periods, but who really cares? You know, I sort of get this, somehow I sort of get a bit of, it's like, well, you know, that's just because women's hormones are complicated and just take the pill to, you know, make up for it or something. That's some of the message I've had. Although, you know, on the one hand, although certainly there are lots of women coming to me who are genuinely concerned that they're not having periods. And the other thing I'll add to that, which I don't think I put in the post, but which I do see, mm-hmm. is these young women, if that's what's happened to them, then when they start eating starches again, they get their periods back. So that, you know, there's another side to it as well. I've seen both, you know, both the cause and then the effect of giving starch back.
Yeah, I think it's a really timely sort of post to write and to bring up, because I think, you know, fat is sort of coming back, you know, we're like not quite as afraid of it anymore. Time magazine had butter on the cover last year. I mean, there's kind of this there's more acceptance, I think, of healthy fats now, but it seems like for some reason, again, that pendulum has kind of really swung the other direction with carbs. And it's either like you're going to eat a ton of carbs, like unlimited sugar, like that's not a problem. And then on the other hand, you have people who are afraid to eat, like you said, a potato, which totally makes me mental. But it's one of those things. It's like, you know, follow people who are giving good information. Don't just sort of latch on to these sound bites. And I can see why it's confusing. I mean, I don't know about in Australia and New Zealand, but here in the States, you kind of get that, like, you know, coffee's good, coffee's bad. Fat is good, fat is bad. Carbs are good, carbs are bad. And it's an onslaught. It's hard for people to, I think, know where to start.
Of course. And one, I'll just interject with one little thing, is that my, and I'd love to hear what you think your clients, how they perceive the word carb. Mm. But my patients, most of them, when they hear carb, they think starch, they think potato. Basically, that's what they think. They don't think, I said this earlier, they don't think the fruit juice. They don't think the sweetened yogurts or the, you know, date balls, or like, that's not a carb in there in a lot of the, you know, understanding of a lot of my patients. So again, what I'm finding is that they've missed the bullseye. Like they probably do need to go lower carb in terms of removing those sugary foods, but that's not what they're doing. They're removing, you know, starches from their evening meal and then binging later because they're so hungry.
Yeah. It's such an important point to mention. I think in the athlete community, what I do see quite a bit is there's kind of a movement for quantifying your macros. And I think, you know, having some knowledge of that is very important especially for people that are training very hard. If you have no idea how much food you're eating, it's very common, I think, for people to really undereat and not eat enough to fuel their athletic performance. But what I do see with the carb stuff too is like, I don't think people should be perfect with their intake, what they eat, and certainly trying to strive for perfection can oftentimes lead to that sort of restriction and binging sort of cycle. But what I see a lot is like, well, okay, you're supposed to eat this many carbs a day to fuel your performance, and let's make them all as sugary and low quality as we can.
Yes.
I'm kind of left scratching my head thinking, where have we missed the mark here? You know, and like you were saying, a sweet potato or a potato makes people freak out. But then again, it's like, well, in your post-workout recovery period, have all the unlimited sweet, whatever, like
have a smoothie or something.
Well, candy or Kool-Aid or stuff like that. Yeah. And I'm just kind of, it just makes me scratch my head a bit. You know, certainly there are some individuals who probably do fine on that stuff, but I think a vast majority of people would do a bit better to think about the quality of what they're getting, not just the quantity.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So this has been so informative. I wish we could keep talking, but we were saying earlier, I'm going to save some stuff because maybe we'll have you back on the show.
I'd love to come back. You're so easy to talk to.
Good. I'm glad I try. I ask every guest, you know, we're kind of talking about, you talked about hormonal resiliency, which I think is a super great term, but you know, I'm interested in what it takes to build human beings that are more resilient and more, the term I use is unbreakable, which is, you know, flip in some ways. But on the other hand, like, I think it's important to talk about that resiliency and robustness. So
yeah,
what do you think? What is kind of the most important ingredient if we want to build unbreakable humans?
Absolutely. It's such a great question. I'm going to cheat a little bit and just say two things.
Okay.
I'll say my first thing is obviously don't take hormonal birth control. Mm. You know, that's just a given to me. But I do also want to, in that big sense of, you know, for both men and women and what I see in my patient population and what I myself is to know what gives you joy and to do more of that.
I love it.
Because I'll just say, you know, we can fall into the trap of just thinking everything's about health, you know, everything's about food, everything's about exercise for health. And yet very often I'm just trying to stop my patients and say, okay, listen, okay, that's all great, but now just tell me what gives you joy. What is the thing you love to do? You know, it's often, and I love hearing what it is, whether it's singing or writing or, you know, reading, walking in my case.
Yeah.
And that's what fuels the, what it's all for.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love that. You know, I think you're so right. I think there's this tendency to kind of get really narrow in your view and get very analytical and think, you know, I'm trying to do the best I can to, you know, give myself the best shot at longevity or give myself the best body composition or give myself the best whatever. And I don't know. I kind of think like if you're not enjoying it along the way.
For me, health is not a goal per se. My goal is to hike as many mountains as I can basically in this lifetime. You know, this, so that's one of my goals. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, so for me, exercising and eating well, it's largely in service to that. It's like, you know, I want to be around, I want to be strong, I want to be able to do these things, I want to be able to do my work and help people. And so that's why I'm healthy, not for its own endpoint.
Mm. That's just such a great way of phrasing it. I really appreciate that. Very, very cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So the last thing I do in the show is a little section that I call the gauntlet. And it's a surprise. So surprise. it's a surprise. But it's a few questions that are just rapid fire. You say the first thing that comes to your mind. All right. So the first one is, every day I start my morning with?
Journaling. I do. I keep a private journal. I do it online now, but I write just thoughts about. Awesome. And
very, very cool. Favorite vegetable?
I'm really into leeks these days. I don't know why. Just frying up leeks in butter almost every morning for breakfast. I just, sweet and
They're delicious and I believe they are quite underappreciated.
Yeah, I agree.
best place you've ever traveled, and I'm going to put a stipulation on here and say you can't say New Zealand because you live there.
No, fair enough, because I live here. No, I wouldn't. Actually, my favorite spot is a place called Tombstone Provincial State Park, or not state, sorry, in the Yukon. Tombstone Park, Yukon, Canada. I did a backpacking, a few nights overnight hiking in there, and there were grizzly bears and tundra, and it was just amazing.
That sounds fantastic. And cold.
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
And it's 24-hour daylight.
So high north. Very cool. Yep. What book are you reading right now, if any?
I'm reading a book of short stories by, her name's Alice Munro. It's a Canadian, because I'm Canadian, mm-hmm. Canadian short story author. Yeah, she's beloved of mine. Yeah.
I'm going to check that out for sure. And the last one is advice you wish you could have given yourself when you were 20 years old.
I think it would be, and I'm still struggling with this a bit, don't worry so much about what other people think.
Yeah.
To eat in the, yeah. That's all that needs to be said. That's not what needs to guide us, I think. Yeah.
I think that's something that many of us struggle with, myself included. So you're not alone there.
No.
Well, you survived the gauntlet. See, flying colors.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, I never know what's going to happen. And now I know that if we ever see or we're ever get the chance to see each other again, we're going to eat something with leeks in it. So,
yeah.
So tell people where they can connect with you and remind us the name of your book, okay. Which I'll hold up for those of us looking on YouTube there.
Yep. Period Repair Manual.
Yep.
And you can find my blog, LaraBryden.com. And I'm on Twitter at LaraBryden. It's all the same.
Very cool.
Instagram at Laura Brad.
Yeah. Awesome. We'll link that up in the show notes so people can connect with you. And I know I've sent already some ladies your way to go get your blog posts or to check out your book because it's all very fantastic stuff. And I appreciate what you're doing to help educate us, yeah. Men and women, about what's going on here and really trying to take this into the mainstream and start conversations about it.
And empower women. And I'll just close by saying, you know, I really, just even this week, things have happened this week, I'm just starting to feel more and more that I'm part of something much bigger. There is a revolution happening around women's health. And it affects men too, because, you know, they love us and they're part of our lives and it's all happening. And it's very exciting.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Laura Bryden, thank you so much for coming on Harder to Kill Radio. And I can't wait to have you back in the future.
Great. Thanks, Steph.
Thank you. That is a wrap. Thank you so much again for tuning into the show and hearing all about the incredible information that Dr. Bryden had for you. Remember, if you'd like to grab links to the things that we mentioned in the show, go to the show notes for this episode. You can find them at stupideasypaleo.com/40. And if you're loving the show, please head over to leave a quick review or a rating, or even better, hit that subscribe button, and that's on iTunes. So to get there very easily, head to stupideasypaleo.com/review. If you hit the subscribe button every Tuesday when I publish a new episode, it's going to automatically show up wherever you listen via iTunes, which is really, really convenient. Okay, a little sneak peek into next week's interview. This one is a tearjerker for me because it's super close to my heart. I'm interviewing a high school teacher who's making it his mission to provide his students every single week with a positive adult role model. This show is, man, it really is an emotional one for me. It's an incredible show. You're going to walk away thinking anything is possible. And until then, stay healthy, happy, and of course, harder to kill.